Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's June 16th, 2017. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. We're recording a very special live show with our friend Steve Hindy of Brooklyn Brewery to discuss beer and food manufacturing and zoning issues in New York City. And Steve, thanks for coming on the show.
Good to be here, Jimmy.
You know, it's funny, this show started, you had written an op-ed piece in Crain's Business New York about this same issue, and I was on a tour with some NYU food studies students in Gowanus looking at food and beverage manufacturing facilities, and we were at Emily Elson's place, the 4 and 20 Blackbirds. And
great place.
And she mentioned you were an advisor, so yeah. Then we started cooking up the show along those lines.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Emily with 4 and 20 Blackbirds has faced the same kind of challenge I faced in trying to find space to build a brewery. For her, it's building a bakery for the wonderful pies she makes. You know, we got established in Williamsburg way back in 1990 when there was a lot of empty space there. And then, of course, that area has developed since. And even though we're in an industrial business zone, hotels have popped up all around us. So we had pretty much given up staying in that area, and we're looking for a space outside of our home for about 5 years. And then, you know, 2007, when there was the big crash of the economy, suddenly, the landlords around us were willing to rent to us, so we were able to expand in 2008. Mayor Bloomberg came and cut the ribbon. But now we're kind of trapped again. But fortunately, Mayor de Blasio has changed the zoning rules in that industrial business zone, so you can no longer build hotels or any kind of commercial enterprise unless you have an industrial tenant at the base. So we're hoping we're going to be able to go up a few floors because we need a lot more office space now and perhaps build a restaurant in the next couple of years.
That's great. And let's introduce the other guests. Everyone, just please say your name and what you're doing here.
Hi, I'm John Bedard from Kushner Studios. I'm an architect and I've worked with a bunch of distilleries and breweries in New York City.
And what are a couple breweries that you've helped?
I've worked with Threes, KCBC, Five Boroughs, Grimmel's, Evil Twin, a few others as well.
And you spend a lot of time in the Department of Buildings?
I do, unfortunately, sometimes. But it's worth doing to get things done. I've also worked with Kings County Distillery and Port Morris Distillery up in the Bronx.
You're going to give us a different perspective. The other guys are entrepreneurs, and you're actually there working on permits and getting places open.
I'm figuring out how to get NYC to accept these uses in different buildings where they just, you know, see the word brewery and they don't even know what it means. And, you know, from giving stories to the examiners and having to describe how to make beer and having to kind of compare it to tea so that they can wrap their head around how it all works and why it's not like a very dangerous operation like you think it is.
Steve, when you first opened Brooklyn Brewery in Williamsburg, you know, what was going on then with, like, the city and permits and You know, were they open to having breweries in the city?
Well, not really. I mean, they were kind of baffled when we first went to the building department with the idea. Actually, even getting licensed back in the 80s, the State Liquor Authority had not licensed a brewery in decades. So it took quite a while just to get the license. And then building the brewery, there were a lot of similar hurdles. But actually, we had gotten to know the powers that be in Brooklyn by then. And, you know, Marty Markowitz and the borough president and the people at DEP did their best to help us speed the process of building the brewery. So I got to say, you know, by 1995, when we built that brewery, they were more receptive to it. And I think they are too today, but still, you know, it's a challenge when you're starting from zero.
We know that in the last few years, the state with Governor Cuomo has really streamlined the state level applications and, you know, farm brewery licenses, and we've had great shows about that. But it still seems that, you know, municipality wise, there's different codes and different. Like I know in Southold, in North Fork, Long Island, I know that our friends at Threes were thinking of opening a brewery, but there's a lot of issues with like tasting rooms and parking that gets in the way.
Yeah, I mean that's obviously an issue that comes out in Long Island, just because parking is such a big deal there. One of the first projects I worked on related to this would be Kings County Distillery. And it was an interesting, because that was the first kind of distillery brewery that came to our office. And they were on Meadow Street for a while, kind of just doing their thing. And then they wanted to open up something bigger. And it was a real challenge to find a space, first of all, that would accommodate them. And then they found the building in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And even that process where it's, you know, city-owned property, and you're going through small business services, it was very difficult because they couldn't wrap their head around how a distillery functioned and how it was going to be a safe manufacturing area and safe for people to come in and taste, you know, the whiskey being made. So, I mean, more than half the time, clients will have secure the license from the state and be legally allowed to brew their beer or distill their liquor before the city actually lets them occupy a building, which is, I mean, crazy.
And it keeps evolving. Yeah. One other point, Steve, is, you know, jobs. You know, you're looking at industrial zoning. You mentioned that there's, like, people want to set up warehouses or, you know, storage facilities. How is that different from actually having, like, a production facility?
I think one of the big plagues on the industrial business zones in New York City is these storage businesses. You know, a storage business basically is a big warehouse with little rooms where people can store their junk. And you know, maybe they employ three people for a massive building, and it's just such a waste of the potential for industrial space. I think it should be disallowed. But the landlords are very much in favor of that because it's a very lucrative business. There's very little overhead. You know, I also think, you know, I spent quite a few years in the Middle East, and I think a lot about what's happening in the world today. And I believe those storage buildings are of real danger from a terrorism point of view, because how easy would it be to assemble a dirty bomb or whatever in your private space in a storage building? I don't think there's any kind of security requirement for those buildings, and I think there should be.
Interesting. And then just talking about all the different types of jobs that come about from food and beverage manufacturing, you know, you guys were talking about breweries. You know, we have friends like the Honey Bar, which is Enlightenment Wines, like mead and cider facility in Brooklyn. And now our other guests, you guys are talking about opening a sake brewery. So why don't you guys introduce yourselves? Tell us a little about what you're going through.
Yeah, hi there. My name is Dutch Fox. I'm with Shinobu Kato. We are opening.
Say hi, Shinobu.
Hi, I'm Shinobu Kato. Nice to meet you.
We're looking to open Sake Brooklyn, which is going to be one of the first sake kuras in New York State, in New York City. You know, right now we're very much in the planning phase, and we're going around and living the zoning nightmares that y'all have been talking about. You know, we're working with brokers. We're working with, you know, architectural engineers trying to find the perfect place to open our brewery. It's a challenge. It's a real challenge.
So what are some of the requirements that, that you need, zoning and beyond, like space-wise and everything?
Well, the biggest one is that brewing in New York City is considered a heavy manufacturing activity. The way that it's zoned is the zonage and use group is brewing is put into the same category as paint factories and concrete factories and lead smelters. So as such, it's the dirtiest type of manufacturing. And this is a legacy. It's a carryover. I think it's from the 60s. Now, they do grant variances, and I don't want to pretend, you know, that the city of New York is blind to what a brewery actually is. But we have to be in M-zoned real estate, which is just a tiny percentage of the geographic space of New York City. It's very, very hard to find a suitable place, much less a place that's zoned M. And frankly, the landlords know when they've got a good spot. So when it's zoned properly and you walk in and say, hey, we're trying to open a brewery, you know, in their head, they're, you know, adding 20% to your rent. It's like when you get married, when you walk in and say, you know, I'm using this space for a wedding, like the base rate goes up 20%, you know, for the wedding markup, you get the brewery markup as well. Just because that good space is so challenging to find.
I had a friend that did that when they got married. They said they were putting together a beer fest and they got a cheap rate. If they had said wedding, they wouldn't have been able to afford it. So John's nodding his head. Our architect here, this is a lucky show because our friend Jordan Greenberg, who was on last year for the Beer Trademark Show, I guess he represents both you, John, and you guys at the Sake Brewery. You're nodding your head.
Yeah, I mean,
this is your topic.
It's just very interesting to me because, you know, the way it's equated in zoning a brewery to a lead smelter, it's just like it's so bizarre once you know how an actual brewery works. And it's one of the, you know, it's a challenge normally for, you know, we have so many restaurants that come to us to do work, and the biggest problem is when people come to do a restaurant, they say, hey, I've signed a lease, you know, let's get started. And I look at where the building is, and it's in a residential only district, and it has no CFO for commercial, and you have to say you can't use it, you know. And similarly, people come to me with ideas of where they want to put their brewery. And as you said, it's heavy manufacturing. So it technically, when you first read the zoning, it's only allowed in M3, which is like, you know, it's M1, M2, and M3. M3 being the rarest of the areas in the city. But there is, you know, a workaround that allows you to have it in M1 and M2. You know, it's not only, that's like hard for regular people to understand, it's even harder for the Department of Buildings to understand. You know, but we've read it and we're sure we've gone to city planning and confirmed it. But, you know, it never fails when we bring something to them to say, hey, we're going to open a brewery here. Their first thing is, no, you can't do it. And half the 3 months is spent proving why you can, why they didn't read their own zoning. It's always fun.
You know, it would be great if the city council took a whole new look at manufacturing in New York City, because the definition that Dutch was talking about is based on manufacturing in the 19th century. Yeah. It has nothing to do with the micro-manufacturing that most of us are involved in the city. And the dangers are far less than a massive industrial project. But, you know, you got to go by the rules, and the rules are based on the old school definition of manufacturing.
Yeah, I mean, as you were saying, the zoning is from 1961, and yes, they updated, but I don't know when the last time they updated that definition of zoning use groups, and it just stays there. And they're thinking of the old distillery wars in the Navy Yard when that was happening, and that seems like how they still view it.
What's that, John? You got to give us more information.
The distillery wars?
Yeah.
I don't know the time period, unfortunately, but it's prior to around when Prohibition was happening, that, you know, there's all these distilleries, and the way it worked, you know, basically people were always fighting for space and fighting for their own territory. So there was a time when that was the biggest crime in New York City, where distilleries fighting one another for territory and for control of the whiskey being produced.
Wow.
And I was going to say, to piggyback on what Steve was saying, you know, really the zoning, I guess, from a higher level as you're looking at it, is to separate, you know, the residential areas and the commercial areas from dirty manufacturing, from, you know, concrete manufacturing, from smelting plants, you know, to keep the livable spaces livable. And
oil refineries.
And heating oil places. But you know, the notion is to separate residential areas from restaurants and then keep the industrial, the manufacturing, the dirty, the loud, the polluting away. And it makes sense, but there does need to be a common sense look at the fact that brewing beer, you know, on a relatively small scale, brewing beer on a small regional scale isn't a dirty business, and it's not loud. And frankly, people want breweries in their areas. Like, you know, the residents of New York City want to be able to go to breweries. We're not bad neighbors. We're great neighbors.
Yeah, craft breweries have had a very positive impact on communities all around New York City. Mm-hmm. And I think anyone who lives near Threes or Other Half or, you know, any of the craft breweries in New York City is happy to have a good neighbor.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Threes went in 2014, give or take. And, I mean, since then, that strip of Fourth Avenue, you know, Osaka opened up, you know, Brooklyn Boulders was maybe started already, but then Strong Rope is there. I mean, I just feel like it helped people say, oh, it's okay to be here and open businesses. And now there's very kind of like collaborative and supportive businesses in that area.
Hey, we're off to a great start. Vito, we're going to be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Heritage Foods USA is a farm-to-table online butcher and founding sponsor of Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Foods got its start when Patrick Martin's first stepped foot onto Frank Reese's Kansas farm in 2001. Back then, Frank was the only farmer in America raising true heritage turkeys with recorded lineages tracing back more than 150 years.
Patrick knew instantly he'd found a unique moment, an opportunity to go beyond acknowledging these breeds as being jeopardized and to actually do something to save them. Patrick asked Frank to ramp up production and made a promise to him that if he would raise them, Heritage Foods USA would sell them.
That was the moment that Heritage Foods slogan, "Eat 'em to save 'em," was born. By creating a market for delicious meats from heritage breeds, we can ensure they'll be around for generations to come.
Plus, heritage breeds just taste a whole lot better. Learn more at heritagefoodsusa.com and use the code HERITAGERADIO for 2 free pork chops with your first order, brother.
Hi, I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're hosts of Ferment About It, a weekly journey of all things fermented on Heritage Radio Network.
Tune in on Mondays at 7 p.m. to hear about all things fermented, from sauerkraut to sourdough and all things between.
Support our show and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming.
Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. You know, it's our summer member drive. Check it out, heritageradionetwork.org. It's a good time to join and become a member. So our good buddy Steve Hindy's here from Brooklyn Brewery. We're talking about food and beverage manufacturing and zoning. That's kind of that's what beer's about. You know, you got to get, you know, permits and open. But we're drinking it's a great surprise that came in. I always love the beers on draft at Roberta's. And today I've got a Brooklyn Brewery Roberta's Special 257 Lager. And it's pretty great. That's our first beer we're drinking.
Yeah, it's a very, very nice beer, and we're happy to have it here at Roberta's.
And, you know, I we're talking about permits and business, but really, I mean, you're one of the great craft beer experts, and you've written some great books. Last time you were on, we had featured your Craft Beer Revolution book.
Right.
What do you think of this beer? I mean, it's probably the first time you tried it as well.
I think it's delightful. It's got a nice, crisp finish to it and, you know, a very nice malt character.
Yeah, so big cheers to Roberta's in Brooklyn. This is a great, great beer, and we're happy to have it for lunch on Friday. And it's a special show where, you know, we put this show together basically because Steve could attend, and we're talking, and we've got an architect, and guys are going to open up a sake brewery. So, Steve, you know, you at one time, you know, Evolution, you guys stayed in Brooklyn. I feel like that around, whatever, 2008-09, you decided to stay. I feel like that was the turning point in New York City brewing, because at the time you were considering leaving New York or not producing here. And I know other guys like Single Cut were looking at places like Rockland County. And once you guys stayed and expanded your original brewery, I feel like that was somehow that opened the doors and a lot more breweries opened.
Yeah, but amazingly, the only reason we were able to expand was because of the crash of 2007. And real estate went through the floor. And suddenly the landlords in Williamsburg were eager to rent to us. So that was the reason we were able to stay. And I know the sake guys are not wishing that New York goes into another recession so they can find space. But, I mean, the facts are that's what enabled us to expand back then. You know, another big project that we were working on in like the last 5 years, you know, we brew beer in upstate New York with the Matt Brewery in Utica, New York. We have an incredible relationship with them going back 30 years. But we're at capacity there, and we're at capacity in Brooklyn. So we were looking to build a very large brewery, actually more like the 19th century breweries, in Staten Island. About 5 years ago, we started working on that project on a site south of the Gothels Bridge where they were talking about doing a NASCAR track at one point. It's a huge 500-acre site. And we were looking for about 30 acres of that property. It was owned by these Texas real estate guys. And we spent north of $1 million planning that brewery, which would have been a million-barrel brewery. I mean, it would have been a major industrial site in New York City. Probably would have employed, you know, 150 people. And in the end, the Texans sold that site to Matrix, which is a big warehouse company out of New Jersey, I think. And it's just going to be a distribution center, mostly for Amazon. And that killed what I think would have been the biggest industrial project in New York City in probably 50 years.
And what is it? Why wouldn't that have happened? You know, or why is that? Why would have that been important for New York? I mean, it seems like everyone talks about, tech zones and the next Silicon Alley happening in Manhattan, but no one talks about this issue.
Well, I think, you know, to a large extent, planners in the city gave up on industry many, many years ago. You know, it's only in the last couple of years that actually industrial employment has gone up in the city. And the reason it's gone up is because of artisanal companies like Brooklyn Brewery, you know, starting up and employing more and more people every year. This would have gone to a different level, this brewery that we were hoping to do in Staten Island. As it is, we're going to be expanding, but it's not going to happen in the city.
Great. And then you guys, you know, you're also involved in Gowanus. So talk about super local. We had a little epiphany earlier. You live in Gowanus. You're on the board of what, the Gowanus Conservancy?
Yeah, I'm on the board of the Gowanus Canal Conservancy, a great organization actually dedicated to expanding parkland in the Gowanus Basin. So, you know, definitely that canal is going to be cleaned up, and there's going to be development on either side, and we want to see a park along the canal for the future of that area. And we have a fundraiser on Monday night, if you don't mind my getting a plug in, at Bell House. So I hope everyone comes down. The ticket price is not that high. We have some music, and it'll be a fun night, and it's for a great cause.
So also in Gowanus, we know our friends are other halves there, 420 Blackbirds Bakery,
Threes,
Folks Beer,
Strong Rope
there.
Yeah. You know, 6 points in Red Hook.
Are you guys fighting to keep any industrial zoning?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's going to be a rezoning there the same way there was in North Brooklyn. And, you know, our councilman, Brad Lander, has done a really good job kind of preparing the groundwork for that. There are a lot of significant industrial businesses in Gowanus, and we want to see them stay. And we want to see parts of Gowanus that have not been developed yet to develop for industrial. You know, I hope the sake brewery can come to Gowanus. I'd be delighted to come to your tasting room.
We'd love to. It's such a great area, and you can tell, you know, when you're walking around there that it's right on the cusp of becoming, you know, a truly great area. It's got the subway access. You know, it's got the close-in residential. You know, I love the work that you guys are doing for the Gowanus area, because you can just tell in you know, 5-7 years, it's going to be one of the great places in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what you guys are doing, because you're the image of these new startup, artisanal, you know, small batch producers. So what kind of a system are you going to have to make sake?
So sake is brewed using typically a tonnage of rice system. So it's not like a barrel type of system. So we're looking right now at putting in a 2,000-pound system. So each batch will run off about 2,000 pounds of rice. It roughly equates to maybe a 7-barrel brewery. It doesn't exactly work that way, but you know, you're talking about jobs. Like, we're putting the craft in craft sake. It's not automated. We're hiring a lot of people. We're going to have guys shoveling rice, and you know, part of the things that we're doing is you know, we want to do well by doing well. I mean, we're planning on paying a good wage. We've already budgeted in health insurance for everybody. So it's not, you know, you're talking about these warehouses that come in and employ two people. We're the opposite end of that. We're trying to hire a bunch of people, and we're trying to pay them well, you know, and being a part of the community. You know, we want, you know, to look after our employees, you know, hopefully in the same way we can kind of grow as a partnership. That's part of the reason why we wanted to be in Brooklyn, was to be part of that.
Shinobu, just say a few words about, you know, how you make sake. You know, what's your vision? And
so, you know, sake is quite common in Japan, as you can imagine. And then, you know, every city has their own, you know, local breweries. And people go there, people enjoy, people gather, something like that. Well, that's not happening in the U.S. It's still like mystical, you know, drink, like rice wine. And people don't know, probably like 95% of the Americans have tried a typical hot sake, which to me is more like a cooking level sake that you cannot enjoy. So we try to make sake more like a real, as in back in Japan that I used to enjoy. And then that's more like community, and then, you know, local, and, you know, handmade, and then, you know, have fun.
So to tell kind of an old story, you know, in Japan at weddings, when people come together, two opposite families come together, one of the things that's traditional is they get a barrel of sake and the whole family drinks from that sake, and it symbolizes coming together. And also going back, you know, hundreds of years in the Shogun era, one of the things the Shoguns did is, you know, if there were two feudal leaders fighting, the Shogun would lock the two leaders in a room and say, you're not coming out until you drink that barrel of sake. And that's how people came together. That's how problems were solved. So you know, part of the history and the lore of sake that we're trying to bring to Brooklyn is that notion of coming together, you know, bringing everybody together, you know, come to our brewery, enjoy some sake.
And John, you know, you've got a number of breweries as clients, as an architect. You brought some beers. What are we tasting right now?
Right now you're enjoying the KCBC Computer Phone, which is a German IPA. So all the hops are German hops.
That's good. What do you think of it, Steve?
It's nice.
Yeah.
It's Pilsner malt, I guess, huh?
Yes.
It's very light.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great, all these different
things. Not only hoppy for an IPA, and, you know, because I feel like a lot of the newer IPAs are very, you know, very hop-focused, which is great, but it's also great to try different styles. I think that's one of the things I enjoy, like, when I first started doing this, like, I drink IPAs.
Do you get paid in beer?
I don't. I was actually just talking about having to add a clause that
to get your sake barrel.
I have to get beer at every meeting with these guys. But I used to just drink IPAs. Now I love sours and I love a good pilsner. So it's like it's been a great like experience of like really learning these different styles and never realizing.
Go to your house for Christmas. You'll get a case of Brooklyn Sriracha Ale this year, I'm sure.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. My wife says our refrigerator looks like a very rich college kid's fridge because of all the different beer.
Let's pop the Sriracha Ace, too. That's one of my favorite Brooklyn Brewery beers. And then, John, so at KCBC, case and study, you know, were there any particular issues that you can talk about that you had to go through in getting that brewery open? Because they opened, what, 2 years ago now?
Yeah, just about 2 years ago. I mean, I have to say, you know, for their credit, their project was a very nice, straightforward project because they took over a one-story warehouse building in Bushwick on Troutman. And, you know, no other impediments. Like, we had full control over what was being filed and how things were being done, so we didn't have to deal with, you know, other people's mess ups and other things impeding us. And it was probably one of the most successful, straightforward openings and projects we've had, which is great. I mean,
and then the brewery that everyone talks about is Grimm. Mm-hmm. You know, that they've become cult like, and they're so you're also working with them to open in Brooklyn.
I am, yes. And they're going to have a 30 barrel system going in on Metropolitan Avenue. Again, a one story building, so it's very very straightforward, and it's I think it's a 9,000 square foot space.
But so there are, you know, like I remember a few years ago when Finback opened, they found a space in Glendale, or you know, a lot of these end of the line places like Single Cuts in Astoria, about half a mile from the subway.
Yeah.
Gun Hill and Bronx,
a good 20-minute walk,
they're about half a mile from the subway.
Yeah.
I mean, there are still a lot of neighborhoods with these type of industrial buildings.
Sure.
Warehouses.
I mean, you know, there are, I think the key is to try to, find a space that you can work in. You know, the hard part is when you're trying to work in a building that has multiple uses and trying to fit the brewery in there. You know, it's standalone, it's a much simpler process. When it's mixed up with a bunch of other things, it gets a little bit more difficult. And it's harder to find these spaces that, you know, are at an affordable price for a brewery to occupy. I mean, there's a lot of upfront cost that is, like I was saying to the guys that from Sake, that, you know, if you look at the upfront cost for a restaurant, the trouble of opening a restaurant, if you multiply that by 50, then you have a brewery, because it's just you're putting a lot of money in before you put a shovel on the ground.
The biggest challenge for us was finding a place with enough headroom, enough height for our tanks. You know, we need like a minimum like 35-foot ceiling to be able to move our tanks in. And even as it is, they're kind of crammed in there. I mean, our brewery feels like a New York City apartment, you know. Very high rent and very little space.
And to be clear, too, when we're in the planning phase, so I've got, you know, insane Excel sheets, you know, doing the math. But it's no surprise when I tell you this, that, you know, the taproom sales for a small brewery are, you know, critical, absolutely critical. In fact, it's almost impossible to get off the ground without good taproom sales, just because, you know, it's such high margin, it's great marketing, and it's the easiest sale you can get when somebody's already in your brewery. Now, to be clear, you know, I've kind of lamented that there's not enough M space out there. There is M space, but it's just way out there. And it's not in a place where, you know, you're ever going to get any walk-by traffic. It's, you know, a huge hike from the subway. It's, you know, in areas that you know, you want to be careful after dark, things like that. So there is M space out there, but it's just way out
but
there.
But, you know, Dutch, I don't want to disagree with you here, but we're here at Roberta's, right, in Bushwick. Our first warehouse was about a block from here. And in 1987, truck drivers refused to come in here after dark.
Really?
So, you know, don't discount the fringe places, because it could be tomorrow's happening place, like Roberta's.
That's true. You told me on the way over, we met on the subway, and I'm glad you said that, because I was just going to ask you about that. It's a great anecdote. I mean, I've never been to Bush. I remember when Roberta's opened. You know, it was like 2007 or 2008, and I had some friends that were cooking here, and I was like, "Oh, it's Roberta's Pizza. It's in Bushwick," and it seems so far out. And the radio network is what's brought me out here. So, you know, cheers to Roberta's. Hey,
yeah.
All right, we're gonna take another short break, and we'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
All right.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. One more push for become a member of heritageradionetwork.org. Check us out. There's a summer membership drive going on. A lot of incentives to become a member. I'm a member, and I went to a great party the other night at Topaz, a cool bar on the Montrose stop of the L train. You know it?
Yeah, I worked on that project.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
That's like, to me, that's another example of the L train at Montrose was kind of a quiet stop, and it's a nice little bar.
Yeah, I just did another place next door called Barra Brava at 253.
So you're doing design for all types of
businesses? Yeah, I know. I do a lot of restaurants and bars and breweries. It's the way to live a life.
So now we're going to taste some sake from these guys. But Steve, you got another story for us. One of your favorite articles about starting a business.
Yeah, this is a story I was going to tell to the sake guys here because they're just getting going. So this story appeared in Inc. magazine, 1987, written by a guy named Wilson Harrell, who was the publisher at the time. And the title of the article was Entrepreneurial Terrorism. And he told a story about during World War II, he got shot down over German-occupied France. And he was rescued by the French resistance. And he lived on a farm with the resistance for a time, sabotaging the Nazis. So they were blowing up bridges and trains and all that kind of stuff. And the Nazis periodically would come and search the farm looking for people like him, American saboteurs. And the French would bury him in a field about 6 inches below the ground. They'd put a little straw up through the earth for him to breathe through. And the Nazis knew that they would do this, so the Nazis would tromp around in the field and plunge their bayonets into the ground anywhere it looked like it was disturbed, trying to find people like this guy Wilson. And he said, that's what it's like when you start your first business. So you guys are in for a great adventure.
And I'm going to add in, every time over the years, and I've had, over 20 years, I had a little bar restaurant in New York. Everyone comes to me and says they want to open a place, I usually spend about half an hour telling them the reasons they shouldn't. Because if you don't, exactly what Steve just said, you have to be able to put up with all that BS if you really want to stick it out. So are you ready for that?
Absolutely.
You're probably more ready than any of the rest of us ever were.
Well, the thing is that I'm blissfully unaware of what I'm unaware of. 10 years from now, I may look back and be like, this was the stupidest decision I've ever made. But right now, I'm looking forward to
it. Well, hopefully in 10 years, you'll be an overnight success.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're hoping for.
Actually, isn't it, they say it takes about 20 years? 20 years to become an overnight success.
It took me 15, I think.
Hopefully.
I want to get Shinobu on more. So we're tasting your sake.
All right.
Tell us about this. I love your accent, too. It's like BBC, the accents. Steve, I wish you had like an English accent today or something. You can probably do it.
Sorry.
So this sake is, you'd call Junmai Ginjo. It's kind of too technical, but it's like all rice, no additive, and then it has more flavors than your typical cooking sake. So it's fermented in very cold temperature, and it takes 2 months to brew. So it's much more than, the typical beer brew.
What size batch did you...
Right now, I do have a small system in my kitchen.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how much do you make with each batch?
I normally make probably like 20 to 40 bottles of this.
Oh, like a 5-gallon homebrew.
Yeah,
Yeah. It's very nice.
Mm-hmm. So once we get a facility in Gowanus, we can brew more.
Good.
Dutch, how did you guys meet? How did you get into the sake thing?
We have known each other for 13 years. We were drinking buddies in business school. We had a great time in business school. We kind of went our separate ways. I went the Wall Street route. He went to Nissan. And kind of cosmically, we both got sick of our careers right around the same time. And he came to me with what I thought was kind of a crazy idea. But then, I started looking at it and thinking about it and said, this is actually something great we can build. So we've been officially working on it for about 6 months, but we've kind of been planning it for, over a year now. It's something new, something different. And I'm hoping that I can put all my years of experience you know, towards growing this business, towards overcoming all these problems that I'm sure I don't, I'm not even aware of yet. And, you know, he was a process engineer at Nissan, so he knows all about the process of making something, of manufacturing.
You know, it's funny, when I listen to you guys, every day I get many, many emails from real estate brokers. There's a restaurant for sale, a restaurant for sale, a restaurant for sale. And how many spaces are really suitable for what you want to do? Because everyone thinks of a restaurant, cafe, you know, it's on the corner. But for a manufacturing facility, it's different.
You know, it would be great if I grew up in the South, and small breweries, they've passed legislation in Georgia. Small breweries can go into restaurant space, right? Mm-hmm. I would love if New York City would take a similar type look of that, because, you know, as we're looking, I'm walking around, I see all these great spaces. That'd be perfect. None of it zoned properly. Really, what we need is a big 5,000 square foot box. And, you know, as Steve was saying, we need the tall ceilings. You know, we need, you know, ingress and egress. We need a big water supply. Obviously, there's tons of water involved in sake. But, you know, the problem is it's more the zoning than anything else. There's great, great, great properties out there. There's properties we'd love to have. We just can't get into them. It's just a non-starter.
Dutch, you know, you've done this a lot. You're going through red tape, but what are some reforms that you think should happen in New York City? Or there are no reforms and we should just trust professionals like you to cut through the red tape?
I think there just has to be a more practical understanding of how the process is done. I think one of the biggest issues we have with dealing with the Department of Buildings and the DEP and other city agencies is that they don't understand the process. You know, we just went through this with Grim Ales getting their approval for their brewery. And, you know, I made a kerfuffle at the DOB with me, you know, kind of standing my ground and saying I can do it where I want to do it. And towards the end, when the planning examiner is giving me approval, she stopped and was like, how does a brewery work? How do you brew beer? And it was just like, my mind was like, you're exploding, because I'm like, you're harassing me and telling me I'm doing something wrong and I can't do what I want to do, but you don't even know how the process works. And I took out my tea analogy of saying, hey, have you made tea before? Well, you know, it's just the same way. The leaves are the malts and the grains. And then, you know, the hops is like the cinnamon stick you put in it. And the main difference is I put a yeast in my mixture and that eats the sugar and makes alcohol. But they don't – like, the failure to understand how even the process works leads to this very, like, black and white reading of what the zoning says and not a true, realistic, pragmatic understanding of how it was meant to govern and how it was meant to control, you know, separating residential from manufacturing and really things that would hurt people from, you know, industrial stuff.
And I'd add to that, too. I've reached out to them to get clarifications on a couple issues before.
Never a good idea.
So I was going to say, so all the confusion around brewing beer, at least they know what beer is. When I reached out to them, they were like, sock what?
Yeah. I'm probably not, if we work together, I won't call it sake, but
you know, we're going to pass in New York the new rice farm sake brewery.
Yeah. I will say, I mean, that you
it's
know,
a rice farm.
I'm sure that's been brought up already, but the farm license is what has, you know, created all this rush of breweries here. And I mean, the first people that I know that took advantage of it, just from people I worked with, was Kings County, and claiming, you know, they got to be the first distillery in New York City in I don't know how many years, but they were the first ones to kind of, like, you know, take advantage of that new passing of that law way back when. I mean, now it's been 6 years for them. So, you know, and I just remember, you know, going to their small space in Meadow and being like, what are you doing here? And how does this work? And like, being kind of like flabbergasted, and then when they explain it made sense, and it was like a new challenge to try to figure out how do I weave them through this system of arcane rules in, you know, hundreds and thousands of pages of code that no one's really read, and try to open up and have them have a business, because that's the most important part. You know, I work with a lot of entrepreneurs, and what I love about entrepreneurs is that the ideas they come up with, I could never think of. I had two women come to my office. They both made One made cupcakes, one made other pastries, and they both love booze. And they're like, we want to open a bar, a cocktail bar called Butter and Scotch. And I'm like, I don't know what you're saying. You want to pair a cupcake with a martini, but let's do it. Let's figure out where you can do this, and let's get you open, and let's figure out how to get through all this, you know, red tape, and that's what I find the most fun.
Just to give a shout out to you, you're John Bedard, Kushner Studios Architects.
Yes,
working with all these great things.
Yeah,
and Steve's nodding his head. So
I was just thinking, I think New York City might be ashamed if it learned that Georgia is more progressive in enabling small breweries to be built in restaurant spaces than New York City.
And part of the problem, too, is if you look at the zoning law, I don't think it's truly actually been updated since 1961, but what there are is addendums added to the end of it that go refer up to some section 500 pages earlier. You mentioned it earlier, Steve, but really just a wholesale rewrite is really necessary. I mean, look how much the world's changed since 1961. You know, look how much Brooklyn, look how much New York's changed, look how much everything's changed since 1961. It's kind of silly to be using rules written in 1961 in 2017. But I don't know if that's going to happen. It seems like a big bite.
But do you want to preserve the manufacturing districts? That's
I think one thing. I don't think it's a bad idea to preserve manufacturing districts. I think it's a realistic revision or review of the uses and what that means and, you know, where they can go. Brooklyn Winery, which is a place I checked out when we were first working with Kings County Distillery, is an interesting case. They opened up a new place on Franklin Avenue, which is fairly close to where I live. And just being the architect nerd that I am, I was very interested in them opening and wondering if they were going to have any of their – what they're doing for the wine. And they wanted just to have a single fermenter there. And it was like 5-barrel fermenter. I mean, there's something tiny. And they had to go through hoops and hoops just to literally place a stainless steel container with grape juice and yeast, because the DOB is like, you're making your, that's all of a sudden, that's manufacturing, and that's a, you know, class 3 material that is highly flammable, and you can't put that in just a C district. I mean, it's very unpractical.
I mean, from a practical point of view, I think all we need is a more nuanced definition of manufacturing that takes into account light manufacturing as opposed to, you know, smelters and the kind of stuff that you guys were talking about that don't exist anymore in New York City. That's the artisanal manufacturing should be part of the definition of manufacturing in New York City, because it's a thriving industry employing a lot of people. We have 120 people working for us now, and I know probably there are 35 breweries in the city now, and I'm sure you add them all up, there are more than 1,000 people working in brewing, and that can grow if it's possible to get approval for expansion.
I mean, and there's plenty of examples of like the zoning being written around size, capacity, whether that's square footage, whether that is amount you produce. So, like, I mean, they restrict how big supermarkets can be. So, like, if there is that nuance of, like, okay, you know, you're considered a micro distillery or microbrewery if you're producing X amount, which will allow you to go into more places, I think that's just all the better, because I do. I think it brings jobs, and I think it brings back something that, you know, we need and has been a real growth area for New York City.
And since it seems like it's probably going to be too big a bite to get a wholesale rewrite or you know, get legislation passed to change things, it would be better, too, if the enforcement was just more nuanced, but was, as opposed to reading the letter of the law, was looking at the holistic impact on the neighborhood. You know, breweries don't create pollution. They don't create dust. You know, they're not loud. They're not dangerous. It would be better if, you know, we're not necessarily going to change the definition of manufacturing, but maybe we just looked at the net impact it had on the neighborhoods, inclusive of jobs and inclusive of the bad things, too. You know, the drunk customers walking home at 2 o'clock in the morning, like, that needs to be part of the scale. But I wish that there was just more of a nuanced understanding.
Responsibly.
So. I apologize. Yeah. Not everybody does. But I wish there was just a more nuanced understanding of the impact on the neighborhood, as opposed to just when I called them up, they just read code back to me.
I mean, if you think about it, like talking about a wholesale rewrite of zoning. So, you know, the building code was written in 1968, and the first real revision of it was in 2008. Okay. So if you have time to wait, maybe they'll rewrite the zoning. So in the meantime, I think there has to be, I mean, there are, you know, nuanced changes that can be made and should be considered. It's unfortunate that a lot of, you know, people that are there aren't looking at this from a practical, pragmatic standpoint. They're looking at it from...
Steve's going to wrap it up. We're
but
almost done.
I would not discount the possibility of a redo of the manufacturing zoning. You know, look at what Governor Cuomo has done to streamline the state rules on brewing. And the borough president of Brooklyn recently came out with an initiative calling for a single source at the Economic Development Corporation to deal with breweries. So people are aware of the positive impact we've had. The politicians are. And I think there is a possibility of changing things for the better.
That'd be wonderful.
The one thing I want to say, and big shout out to Governor Cuomo and his crew and our buddy Sam Filler, you know, they brought in the best and the brightest, and they redid all the liquor laws that went back to the end of Prohibition. And Steve, I should nominate you. You should be somehow more involved with planning in the city. You know, I mean,
I got enough problems.
And one thing, what's happening Monday night at the Bell House?
At the Bell House Monday night, the Gowanus Canal Conservancy is having their fundraiser. It's a great organization promoting parks in the Gowanus Basin, and hope to see you all there.
And Dutch, you're going to go, and you might find a new space, right?
Absolutely. That's what we're going to be there for.
And then, John, it's so great to meet you. You know, we have so many friends in common. But so you're the guy. If you want to architect for the stars, the architect for the breweries, we got you.
It's something I love to do, and yes, please.
And then Shinobu, I love your sake. Thanks so much for...
Thank you very much. You enjoyed it.
And you can pay John with beer.
And sake.
Or sake.
Or wine.
And a big shout-out coming up now would be our 9th annual July Good Beer Month. It started way back in 2009 just to recognize that New York City is a good beer town, that there's pubs and restaurants serving good beer. And we've come so far, and we're still preaching that message. So check it out, julygoodbeermonth.com. A lot of things going on in New York City. And thanks, everybody. A big shout-out again to... Go around one more time. Everyone say your name and your affiliation.
Steve Hindy, Brooklyn Brewery.
John Bedard, Kushner Studios.
Dutch Fox, Sake Brooklyn.
And Shinobu Kato, Sake Brooklyn, too.
And great. In closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to our guests and for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producer, Justin Kennedy, intern Hillary Fassin, and our engineer today, Vitor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.